Richard Powers is an award-winning American author whose works explore the effects of modern science and technology. He describes his latest novel, The Overstory, as being all about trees, as he told Robert Kirkwood.
If someone who hasn't read it yet, give us an overview of The Overstory.
It's a book about trees and people and the deep, deep connections between them. I set in motion the lives of nine characters who come from very different backgrounds and who have very different temperaments and personal histories, but all of whom are in some way ambushed by trees. And in particular, many of them come together to take part in what we in North America call the Timber Wars, as the activity, the environmental activism in the late 90s and early 2000s to try to prevent the cutting of the last few remnants of old-growth forest in North America.
That's one thing we don't get if we consume the audio version, is the cover of the book. I know there are different covers in different regions, but the one I'm looking at is that a painting of those forests of old?
So you must be looking at the North American cover, which is a painting by Albert Bierstadt, who was a great pioneer for landscape painting in the western part of the United States in the 19th century. And what we've done is manipulate that picture to be reminiscent of tree rings. But there's something striking in the image that I truly love. This is an image of the big trees, sequoias, in California, that Bierstadt was among the first Europeans to see in the middle part of the 19th century. What I love about the picture is you can be looking at this glorious forest and this wonderful brown and green tonal register and only belatedly realize that there are two tiny human figures in the center of the painting on horseback. And then you notice that this enormous sequoia tree that's lying dead on its side on the forest floor towers above even these men on horseback, that the width of the tree is so enormous that it rises above their head even in death.
I remember seeing a postcard years ago of a car driving through a tunnel that had been carved in the root of a tree.
Yeah, and depending on the particular tree, they actually did cut tunnels in a few of these giant sequoias. Your particular tree may or may not last because for some reason, if you take a 3,000-year-old tree and cut the middle out of it, it doesn't last a very long time afterwards. There's some kind of metaphor for human indifference or interference in those fables. But there are two species of gigantic tree that still exist in California, the sequoia and the coastal redwood. These are ancient, venerable trees. It's not unusual among the larger trees that they get to, say, even 10 meters in width and 100 meters tall. And, of course, 1,500 years or older, the sequoias can actually be greater than 3,000 years. So these are just stupendous and spectacular trees. And my characters, as was I when I discovered this, are just completely astounded to think that human beings are still cutting them down, even though 98% of the old-growth forest and a good 95% of the redwood forest did fall under the axe after the arrival of the Europeans.
Has writing the book made you look at the wooden objects in your life in a different way?
It absolutely has. 6 years ago, when I started the book, I was pretty much oblivious to trees. I took them for granted. I might appreciate them as aesthetic objects or be grateful for their shade on a hot day. But I wasn't one who could tell the difference between an elm tree and an ash tree. And writing this story and immersing myself in the lives of trees and the agency of trees and the incredibly rich, complicated behavior and society of trees over 6 years has made me see not just living trees in a different way in the forest as a different kind of entity than I realized it was, but as you say, all the human artifacts that we make that derive from trees with a new kind of reverence and awe. And it's not an exaggeration, as one of my characters says, when you begin to list the amount of derivatives and artifacts and objects that we still make from either wood directly or from cellulose and lignin, the components of trees, to say, it's not an exaggeration to say that we're still living in the age of wood.
You say in the book that the trees live a quiet existence, but it's a quiet existence that's really hiding an industry of keeping themselves alive.
Yes. You know, many of the forests in Britain and in Europe and now in North America have been converted to agricultural purposes, to forestry, to what amounts to tree farms or tree plantations. And in part, we've perhaps justified the use of these creatures as resources because we haven't fully understood just how complicated trees are, how social they are, and how rich a forest ecosystem can be. And we have perhaps been mistaken in believing that trees will always grow back and that no matter how we treat them, they will return. And it was sobering for me to realize as I wrote the book that, in fact, no human being has ever seen an old-growth forest, a rich, complicated, interconnected ecosystem of the kind that exists when a forest is allowed to reach full maturity over the course of millennia. No one has ever seen a clear cut come back to that same degree of richness. So part of the book is to open the eyes of readers, as my character's eyes are opened, to the majesty and the astonishment and the richness and complexity of the neighbors, of the creatures that have made our civilization possible.
And the fact that in the book and in research I've read it elsewhere, the trees actually communicate to each other, and it's not just elm to elm, they communicate across species as well.
Truly remarkable, and this is research that's been unfolding for a few decades now, and it's just starting to percolate into the public imagination and realization. Not only do trees signal each other over the air with chemical semaphores, chemical messages that alert, say, distant trees to an invasion, either of insects or other herbivores. But they are, as you say, connected underground by fungal filaments that will share resources and food and medicines, not just between trees of the same species, but trees of different species. And that a big, mature Douglas fir, for instance, that reaches up into the sun, can actually be sending sugars through these fungal intermediaries to, say, a rather small birch that's been stunted for many decades because it's, it's in a dark, heavily shaded understory. And this notion that, our understanding as nature, of nature as being primarily a competitive phenomenon, red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson says, has to be revised, and that we have to realize that for every act of competition, that there are many, many acts of cooperation going on in a forest. It's this notion that lies at the heart of a book that's essentially a plea for human beings to realize that they, too, are not exceptional and are not separate creatures, but are richly connected and imbricated and reciprocally beholden to, to all kinds of other living things.
There's a character in the book with a sensory disability. It's hearing, it's not sight loss, but that initial isolation that she feels will resonate with a lot of our listeners.
Yes. This is a character named Patricia, and she has a hearing impediment. When she's young, and consequently her her speech is not particularly easy to understand, and her schoolmates tease her mercilessly and isolate her, and she's a bit bewildered by humans because of this this barrier between her and her peers. It's her father who takes her under his wing and teaches her about the richness of the non-human world, and she finds some consolation in having the society of green things open to her, where the society of human beings has remained a kind of tough mystery for her to crack. She tells her father one day that she's astonished that her schoolmates can't tell the difference between one kind of tree and another, and how can that possibly be when they're surrounded by these rich and marvelous things? And her father says, you know, that's Adam's curse. It's a sad thing, but we human beings tend to struggle to identify with or understand anything that doesn't look and feel and behave just like us.
Now, we heard at the beginning Suzanne Torin reading from the audio version, and I think she's got the perfect voice for it. Have you listened to the audio version?
You know, it's very interesting. When the audiobook producers first contacted me, they gave me the choice of three male readers, and they asked me which one I would prefer to perform the book. And I listened to them, and they were all very good. But in the back of my head, I thought, you know, the female characters in my group of nine are actually in the majority and probably the most important characters. And wouldn't it be lovely to have a female narrator? And I wrote to them, and they got very enthusiastic about this idea. And they sent me three samples of three different female voice actors, all of whom were very good. I picked Suzanne Toland because of an intelligence, a nuance, a warmth, and a humaneness to her voice. And I was delighted in her performance that she attempts to render each of these characters with their own vocal signatures and to inhabit almost like a single-person dramatic play all of these different performers, protagonists, both male and female.
Do you think listening to the audiobook changes the reading experience?
Yes, I do. I do think I'm an avid listener to audiobooks. I do think that sometimes, you know, you are at the mercy of the performer in the way that you are with a musical concert. That if the performer doesn't have an affinity for the prose or the piece, they can be an impediment between you and a full immersion. But when the performer is good, as Suzanne Toland is, there's an enhancement. You can actually get more out of the words on the page because someone who has spent a lot of time and thought deeply about the words is bringing you to places and nuances and depths inside the prose that might not have occurred to you.
All books on the Booker shortlist are available in audio and in braille and in giant print for blind and partially sighted readers. Is that an important thing to you?
Absolutely. Just as my book deals with people who, for one reason or another, are prevented from experiencing the world in the way that others of us take for granted, I am deeply grateful for any medium that allows readers and audience to come to my words in a way that opens to them. So much of the book is about taking seriously this notion of the broadness and the diversity and the complexity and the difference behind human experience, and to create these channels of connection and empathy, and it's so important to me to know that readers from all kinds of walks of life and all kinds of experiences have a chance to engage this book and to come to it on their terms.
Have you heard about that? A park, I think it was in Australia, where every tree was given an identification number and an email address. The email was to report damage, but people started writing little emails to the trees. Did you hear that story?
Yeah, I did, and I was so delighted by it. the outpouring. People do feel an intense connection with these other creatures that operate on such different time frames and on such different physical scales and with such different behavior. There is something that really awakens our imagination and our curiosity and our gratitude to not be alone here on this world when that moment happens and we begin to see the agency and the personality of a tree and the fact that so many people, you know, responded directly to the tree and simply wanted to say things from their heart about how much the trees have meant to them. That was very moving to me.
Richard Powers, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.